study,
and play come together on a Windows 11 PC.
And for a limited time, college students get
the best of both worlds.
Get the Unreal College Deal. Everything you need to study and play with select Windows 11 PCs. Eligible students get a year of Microsoft 365 Premium and a year of Xbox Game Pass Ultimate with a custom color Xbox wireless controller. Learn more at windows.com/student offer. While supplies last, ends June 30th. Terms at aka.ms/college PC.
Ready to soundtrack your summer? With Red Bull Summer All Day Play, you choose a playlist that fits your summer vibe the best. Are you a festival fanatic, a deep end DJ, a road dog, or a trail mixer? Just add a song to your chosen playlist and put your summer on track. Red Bull Summer All Day Play. Red Bull gives you wings. Visit redbull.com/brightsummerahead to learn more. See you this summer.
Kusha, how long have you been an interview host?
My first hosting job was in 2016 on PBS, but I was just, not just, I was reading scripts into a camera. And I think my first interview was when I was in seventh grade. And there was a day-long, like, choose-your-own-adventure workshops for everybody to, like, learn about jobs and whatever. And I didn't want
a career day.
Yeah. Or like your skills that you can learn in half an hour sessions. And I didn't want to do any of them. I just want to walk around and talk to other people about what they thought about the sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the teachers suggested that I do this instead. And at the time I was like, I'm special. That's right. I'll do this. But I think in retrospect, they're like, oh, this seems to be what he's interested in. We can like, which is great. Great teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a while for me. How about you?
That is a while. So I was the local host of Morning Edition for the Nebraska Public Radio Station for a few years. And that was, you know, a great experience, lots of on-air time. But then I didn't really do much interviewing to be heard on air until later. I did a lot of interviewing as a reporter where I would talk to people, but usually my voice didn't end up on the tape. I don't think it's really until a couple years ago, a few years before this job, that I began to do more interviewing.
Mm. What do you like about it?
Oh, I like talking to people. I always have. And I like learning how people view the world and what they think, you know, about whatever issues we're discussing. Obviously, here it's largely climate. But I think when done well, it's a way to just get to know somebody. And it's a nice human experience. I don't know. What about you?
It is a total human experience, right? Like, I feel like the thing that so many of us have in common, despite like whatever our job is or whatever our background is that we all want to be understood. And I think that when you listen really intently and you hear what somebody's offering, it can be a very meaningful shared human experience. And I think that reminds me of this week's episode especially, because I got to talk to, and it sounds you as well got to talk to, individuals that had really wonderful stories to share. And mm-hmm. It was really cool to hear it on the other end, because I felt like I was in a very meaningful conversation.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah. So let's get into it.
Yeah.
I'm Ariana Brocious.
I'm Kusha Navadar.
And this is Climate One.
Ariana, this episode feels very special to me because of how much I enjoyed the conversations.
Yeah, I agree.
So I had the opportunity to talk to Gloria Walton, who's the president and CEO of the Solutions Project. And Gloria has channeled tens of millions of dollars into grassroots efforts building resilience.
I talked with Wawa Gaveru, founder and executive director of Black Girl Environmentalist, and she's working to create more inclusive climate spaces and really advocate for a more complete picture of the climate narrative.
That complete picture element, I thought, ran through both conversations. For me, it was very invigorating because some of the themes that came up with Gloria was like, how do you bridge grassroots to philanthropy? What does philanthropy look like in the current environment, especially for climate advocacy? And what is grassroots work really look like today?
Mm-hmm. Right. Both of these women are really focused on local solutions and empowering people. And they know that the people closest to the issues are often the ones who know best how to address them. And sometimes they just need resources or some help.
Do you think they also have a strong interest in like shifting the narrative kind of? I know for me, at least,
absolutely.
We talked a lot about shifting from victimized frontline communities to the narrative of people with agency who are solving their own problems, even if they're ones that they didn't create.
Yeah, I mean, Wawa is really focused on making the climate movement reflect the people that are really within it, you know, not just the leaders that she saw when she first entered the field. And I think what's really empowering about the work that both of these women do is that the solutions that they accomplish are really impactful. There was a July report prepared for the MacArthur Foundation and some others that documents how community-based climate strategies can achieve measurable greenhouse gas reductions in addition to building lasting community engagement.
Yeah, so we've talked about the conversations. I'd love to dive in and listen to them. The community engagement piece especially are the kinds of efforts that are supported by Gloria Walton at the Solutions Project. So let's just jump into my interview with her. I want to start by like acknowledging the moment that we're in, because a lot of people are standing up to climate and environmental injustice, and they're facing challenges that we weren't seeing a year ago. So how are you processing what feels to me like both a political and a cultural change?
You know, my year started with the Altadena fires. And Altadena was my home. Like, that's actually where I lived and where I bought my first home, which is like this historically Black community. And, you know, experiencing the fires there just hit like in a way that you just can't even be prepared for. Like, my heart dropped the minute that my former neighbors called me the night that their home started burning. You know, and that just kind of gives you a sense of how close we were and how the community is. Like, for me to have moved and my neighbors are calling me the night that the fires hit our home is a big deal. And thinking about today and how they're still impacted, because it was kind of like headline news at the top of the year. And then fast forward to today, you know, now we have different fires, but those communities are still in recovery, many displaced, dealing with like the effects of what happens when communities end up being hit by a climate crisis, where you have people from outside the community looking at this land and really seeing an opportunity to kind of swoop in and leverage the disaster to further privatize like the land and the water and accumulate more capital and displace those communities that live there. And all in all, those communities are coming together so that they can actually put forward a strategy so that they can remain in their communities.
Yeah. So even with changes happening one way or another, the tragedy is like being felt very close to home for you, no matter what.
I mean, completely. Like, the empathy just runs deep, because it literally could have been me. And in a lot of respects, it feels like it was, because it affected and impacted people that I deeply care about. You know, these are some of the best neighbors that I've ever had. And the fires is just like, you know, when you think about this political moment, that was just the top of the year. You know, since then, it's like we've had severe rollbacks to DEI, you know, climate policies, the gutting of FEMA and NOAA, right? These are supposedly the first government responders when disasters hit. NOAA being like a federal agency that works to understand like weather and predict weather and climate. You know, I think about communities that we serve, like the immigrant communities that are being targeted right now with the ICE raids. And that's happening in California and all over the country, where it's like job sites, you know, they're targeting schools, hospitals, parks, and other ostensibly safe spaces. And then you think about like the legal, digital, and physical threats that are happening right now to a lot of communities, and the surveillance and the harassment. And we know that there's been like so many federal cuts that have also impacted a lot of the groups and organizations that we support, as well as local communities.
Before we move on, I mean, I'm interested in how your former neighbors are doing.
Yeah, so I appreciate that. You know, they're still struggling. a lot of people have been displaced and they're staying with family. And for those who haven't been displaced, you know, they're also still in their homes and they're now dealing with the public health implications of fire. And we were able to, the Solutions Project, connect the families there with this company and organization called Aclima. And essentially, they do air quality and water quality monitoring. And we connected them to the local community, and they went and they tested the soil and the ground and the homes. And there's basically high amounts of benzene and lead, right? And so these have really serious health implications. And so families are dealing with the public health consequences while like meeting with each other and trying to have a vision for how to rebuild that actually keeps the people there versus displacing them and moving them out and letting developers and other folks with capital kind of swoop in and seize this moment.
Yeah. So now we're getting into some of the work that you do at the Solutions Project. And I think a lot of it is rooted in your own experience too. So before we dive deep into the work now, I think it might help to think about you, Gloria, and what you brought to the table. I mean, before you started what is now a multi-million dollar organization, you worked for 16 years as a community organizer in South Central LA. So what did that experience teach you?
So much. My time at Scope, Strategic Concepts in Organizing and Policy Education, which was my former organization, really set important and critical foundation in my life and for my work. I always say that being born Black in the U.S. and around the world is intrinsically political, but being at an organization like Scope actually took that political awareness and my political analysis and my political experience to a completely different level. You know, I was in college when I started there, and so I did community organizing and learned from some great organizers and leaders to this day, Anthony Thigpen, Mayor Bass, the mayor of Los Angeles, you know, she's a former community organizer in South Central, right? So I had the privilege and the honor of learning from them. And what was great about organizing is that it helped me understand and situate my personal experience and my family's experience in a broader context. And it helped me think about the systems that are at play that created a lot of the conditions that we lived in and how we grew up, like the problems in those conditions that we lived in.
Yeah, you know, when we spoke earlier, you told me that you grew up in poverty and yet you also had a sense of abundance, I think is the word that you used. Yeah. How do you simultaneously hold a sense of scarcity and abundance?
Yeah, so, you know, growing up in poverty, I was partially raised in Jackson, Mississippi, but also parts of Northern California. And my mom and my grandmother raised me, and we were conservationists out of necessity. And what that means is that we thrifted, we reused everything, we like conserved energy, right? Like if you're not in a room, you turn off the lights. If you're like when you're brushing your teeth, you don't just let the water run while you're like brushing the whole time, right? Like you turn it off.
We grew up in very similar households. Yeah.
Exactly, right? Like you got to be mindful because they're paying those bills, right? Yeah. So, you know, and that's kind of like that conservationist attitude. And we did that in a sustainability attitude, really, but it was rooted in survival, right? Because it's like, if you already don't have much, like, you're going to be mindful of, like, how much energy you're using, how much water you're using. So that's one serious reality.
Yeah, that's the scarcity side. Tell me about the abundance side.
Scarcity side, right? That many are familiar with, too many, really. But the abundance side, which I think so much about, and a lot of the organizations that we support at the Solutions Project is very central to the work, is recognizing that we're not in this alone, right? And, you know, abundance is knowing that you have neighbors and an entire community that can show up for each other and look out for each other. So when my grandmother went to the grocery store because she had a vehicle, but our neighbor across the street didn't, she would let her know, right? And she would say, hey, I'm going to be going to the grocery store on Monday. Do you want to join me? And we would carpool together. If someone needed certain resources to kind of know how to save money on this particular bill or where you go to get this particular resource, it's like people talk to each other. You know, neighbors just, like, we knew each other's names.
Yeah, you weren't
everyone on the block
own.
Knew me.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. You're not on your own. And there's an abundance in that, right? It's recognizing how much more you can have when you share and pool your resources, right? And it's not just thinking about the little bit that you have, but like, what do we have together?
Yeah, which kind of lies at the heart of what the Solutions Project does a lot. It's finding the communities to help support the projects that you find, which makes total sense. And one more question that I had about your experience as a community organizer is you talked about it helping you put into a systems context what you yourself, Gloria, experienced.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Can you think of a specific example where that systems level thinking or that just like context filled in for you?
Yeah. So, you know, when I started in organizing, I was actually an economic justice organizer. Mm-hmm. And I was often thinking about the economy. And I felt like that was the space that held all of our interlocking systems. And to some degree, it really does, right? Like it holds so much. And my entree point into climate was actually researching the economy and jobs and like thinking about, okay, what's going to be the next big growth sector? And this was way back in like 2006 or something like that, 2005. And I started researching what investments were going to be coming down to create jobs and how to make sure that Black and Brown communities could have access to those jobs. And it was actually climate at that time where I saw and found that it was going to be trillions of dollars that were going to be invested in this new industry. And that it was going to be an opportunity to have like a career ladder, an entree point for new folks, but then also a career lattice if you're thinking about already existing jobs that will be, you know, transformed to cleaner jobs, right? And thinking about how to move from a dirty job to a clean job. And then the more that I delved into climate, I really saw how, okay, this is more than about jobs in the economy. This is about air quality, clean water, the energy transition away from fossil fuels to renewables and solar energy. It's about transportation, food justice, equitable resources, and access to those resources. And that's when I realized that, okay, climate justice is what's interwoven into all facets of society and the systems in which we live. And the reason it became bigger than the economy to me is because climate justice is not just about the economy. It's about people, and it's about our land and our resources and how we interrelate to each other, right? And that's like the real all-encapsulating issue of our time.
I'm really interested in the fact that you brought up people as a part of that, because like this is kind of bringing us to the present now with the Solutions Project. A key tenet of your organization is that the solutions to the climate crisis exist within frontline communities, exist with the people, right? How did you come to that realization?
Organizing. In South LA, we were a community that was defined by the freeways that surrounded us. And it was called South Central because there was a freeway to the north, the south, the east, and the west. And we, our community was at the center of all of that. Plus, we had the ports that were in Los Angeles. So you know that there's diesel trucks coming through our communities on all the freeways that surround our communities. So we actually had some of the poorest air quality in LA County, which meant that we were some of the sickest communities, the highest rates of cancer and other illness, the highest mortality rates compared to other places in the county. And this wasn't happenstance, right? Like there are decisions that are being made every single day that create those conditions that we're living in. And once I realized that, that I learned that from the communities that had already been doing this work. Like I was able to join a legacy of organizers who've been doing this since before I was born.
Yeah.
And I had the honor and the privilege to learn so much from them. And when you kind of narrow it down to the fact that there's people sitting in a room making decisions about your life and my life, and either you can be on the side reaping the consequences of that, or you can actually go in that room and share your perspective, your voice, and your analysis, and your solutions, and have a seat at the table, just knowing that it's that easy, like to make that phone call, to do that delegation to an elected official, it's that easy to help shape your democracy, to shape your community, to influence the real conditions that you and your family are living with.
Well, when you say easy, what do you mean by that? Because I imagine some people will be listening and you be know, like, easy, I don't know.
It's not easy, huh? Right. What I mean by easy is that our democracy is about your power and my power. Our democracy is about community power. And too often, I think it's easy, like a dominant theory of change that we all rely on or defer to is that you just put someone in office and, you know, supposedly they align with your values and what you believe in, right? At least that's what you surmise. And you just kind of leave the decision making up to them. But the power in our democracy is actually saying, okay, yes, I'm going to try to elect someone who I think aligns with my best interests. But I can't stop there because the magic and the power comes with me holding them accountable to my vision and my interests. And that's through voting. That's through making phone calls. That's through lobbying. And you don't have to do these things alone, right? You can link up with your neighbors. You can link up with community organizations to make this happen. But there's a lot of avenues, if we look for them, to be an agent of change, right? And not just like on the sidelines reaping the consequences of other people's decision.
Coming up, Gloria Walton shares her vision of philanthropy.
It's about change, not charity, right? Like it's about solidarity and showing up for the people and the communities and the places that we love.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
When you need to build up your team to handle the growing chaos at work, use Indeed Sponsored Jobs. It gives your job post the boost it needs to be seen and helps reach people with the right skills, certifications, and more. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need a hiring hero? This is a job for Indeed Sponsored Jobs.
So good, so good, so good.
Everything you want for summer is at Nordstrom Rack stores now, and up to 60% off. Stock up and save on the brands you love, like Vince, Sam Edelman, Frame, and Free People. Join the Nordy Club to unlock exclusive discounts, shop new arrivals first, and more. Plus, buy online and pick up at your favorite Rack store for free. Great brands, great prices. That's why you rack.
When you finally find your thing, you want the whole world to know about that thing. So you use a thing called Canva to make it an even bigger and better thing. Whether you want to create flyers for that thing, make presentations for that thing, or design merch for that thing, you can do anything. So people can see your thing, feel your thing, love your thing. The next thing you know, it's a thing. Canva, the thing that makes anything a thing.
This is Climate One. I'm Kusha Navidar. Let's return to my conversation with Gloria Walton, president and CEO of the Solutions Project. One of the initiatives her organization supports is the West Street Recovery Project in Houston, Texas, a state that recently experienced deadly climate-driven flooding.
West Street Recovery emerged in response to Hurricane Harvey. And we know, at least now from like looking at the media, that there's like repeated floods and communities basically have to take their lives into their own hands. And West Street Recovery has been like fighting for these communities and really trying to rebuild this neglected infrastructure in their community. And one thing that I want to mention is that they recently won $20 million for like drainage investment and reversing a 22-year-long city ordinance that basically led to unequal infrastructure in communities of color. And all this happened because of the grassroots organizing that they were doing, the advocacy, and it was all around improving outdated drainage systems. Given that they had so much flooding there, the drainage system is so important to make sure that it's actually up to date. And so when they passed this $20 million victory, it basically increased the local drainage program, and the city started to respond and address a lot of these neglected areas.
So how does a project like that exemplify your personal mission?
Yeah, West Street Recovery, it's grassroots. It's about the community. It's led by, driven by the people most impacted by the problems and conditions. And a lot of the organizations that we support at the Solutions Project are grassroots organizations. So they're local. one of the things that West Street Recovery is doing that a lot of our partners are actually doing is building resilience hubs. Have you heard that term?
No. I was about to ask, what is that?
So resilience hubs, basically, it's like a collective response at the local level where you have community, local organizations, and businesses working together as first responders, boots on the ground, offering mutual aid to each other and mapping community assets and resources.
Well, can you give me an example of a community asset, like a shelter in place location or like?
Yes.
What? Yeah.
Yeah. So like if a disaster hits and in Texas, they are dealing with winter storms, severe heat waves, a hurricane, right? And so if the community is facing any of those and a power outage happens, for example, they've actually mapped who on the block or in the neighborhood is the home that has like backup solar panels and batteries, for example. Who's the point of contact who's going to reach out to the local community who can provide food and water to the community when there's an outage? Because those things end up being a matter of life and death when crisis hits.
Yeah. A quote that I've heard you say before is, our communities are too often depicted as victims when, in fact, we are victors. And there's a lot to unpack there. So first, why do you think frontline communities are portrayed as victims?
Often, our stories are told by someone else. Right now, we're constantly inundated with misinformation, lies, climate denial, and so many counter-narratives that push against us and try to hide the political will that is at play and telling us that we're powerless, right? Which is another lie. And climate change deniers are using their power to gaslight us all right now. Mm-hmm. You know, up is literally down on every issue, whether that's the democracy, climate change, reproductive rights, family values, equity, diversity, you name it, right? And they're using the news and social media to misinform and malign and to invoke fear and overwhelm and to spread hate. Mm. And so they've taken the very narratives that we've created and they have appropriated, undermined, and villainized them because they know that stories are powerful. And so the Solutions Project, we support communities and grassroots movements taking their power and their stories back. And that's literally shifting away from victims to victors and visionaries, and rewriting the narratives from disempowerment to self-determination, you know, and taking control of our stories and showing that solutions don't just come from like the top down, but they actually come from the ground up.
Mm. At the same time, I hear in so many circles, I hear about people of color, you know, here in the U.S. or residents of developing countries, low-lying island nations, they are affected by climate disruption first and worst, right? Like,
yeah,
those who contribute least to the climate injustice in the world are also experiencing the greatest floods, the greatest fires, et cetera. Is that not true? I mean, if people are being hurt by a problem that they didn't cause, isn't that the definition of victim?
Yeah. So if they're being hurt by a problem that they didn't cause, absolutely. One part of the story can be victimization, but the story shouldn't stop there. Mm. And often the story stops there. And so when people think about these communities, that's what they think about. Oh, victims, those poor communities, the people who are impacted by that thing over there, it's not going to impact me. But when communities tell their own stories, they can talk about the problems, right? Because I think that that's important. And it's like a way that people understand the impact of things, but they can also talk about the solution and they can talk about how they overcome those problems. They can talk about their vision. They can talk about the power that they're building. They can talk about who they're in allyship with. So it just creates a more expansive story so that people can actually see themselves in it and know that when disasters hit, it doesn't just begin and end with victimization.
Yeah, in your mind, it is the 360 view of a person who is experiencing a hand dealt that is quite difficult, but it is one piece of that story, is what I hear you saying, which is crucial.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, one root of injustice is the unequal distribution of money. You're now deeply embedded in the world of philanthropy, and you're channeling tens of millions of dollars into frontline communities. And yet that's still a drop in the bucket, right? Like it's been reported that of all the philanthropic dollars that are out there in the world, less than 2% is devoted to climate. And of that, how much of that flows to frontline community organizations? Do you have a sense of that?
A fraction, right? If it's already less than 2%, a fraction of that flows to those who are most impacted.
So for you, I mean, the position that you are in, I find so fascinating because you are looking at what is oftentimes like the lifeblood of change. On one hand, like money makes a huge difference. Money can solve problems. Money can move mountains. How can you change how and where philanthropy dollars flow?
Yeah. So, you know, philanthropy is actually a Greek word, you know, before I chose to be in philanthropy coming out of organizing. And I still identify as an organizer, even though I'm in philanthropy. And that's really important because it's giving you a sense of my purview and who I'm accountable to, which is always the ground and communities and who I'm actually in this work for, which are local communities. And so when I think about the Greek word, once I look this up, it's philanthropia, and it actually means for the love of humanity.
I love that.
Yeah, me too, right?
Yeah, so like, I love that.
When I learned that, I was like, of course, this is what I would be doing. Like, you know, it's about change, not charity, right? Like, it's about solidarity and showing up for the people and the communities and the places that we love. And then the more that I experienced philanthropy, when I ran an organization on the ground scope, it was clear how hard it was actually to get resources to communities that are most impacted by the problems and conditions. And then being in philanthropy, I learned exactly that stat that you just talked about, with the less than 2% going to the communities that are disproportionately impacted by problems and conditions. And so when you look at the flow of capital in philanthropy, because that's the main resource that's moving around, it was actually flowing to well-resourced, predominantly white-led, larger organizations and institutions, and the least amount of resources were actually flowing to the communities most in need. And not from just a victim sense, right? Because the communities most in need are actually advancing solutions in real time. They're not just saturated in victimization. They're trying to create change right now. And that's where the least amount of resources was going. And that's the sweet spot for the Solutions Project, is actually stepping into that gap and painting a picture of, like, if this is about the love of humanity, we're not meeting the mark. Right. And it's having that larger conversation with philanthropy. I have to fundraise, right? Like, you know, we all fundraise at the Solutions Project because we raise this money to move to communities that are on the front lines.
You know, you've been recognized for, quote, wrangling $43 million from Jeff Bezos. And you got that for climate work, climate justice work. How do you navigate relationships with major philanthropists while maintaining grassroots authenticity?
I actually helped to raise about $151 million for the movement. Mm. And part of that is also thinking about accountability, because as great as it was to raise that kind of capital, you know, we started off with a small amount that was offered to us and amplified that up more than like 10 times the amount that was offered to us. Basically, it was like a $2 million conversation transformed to a $151 million conversation that supported many organizations. But I also made sure that they were clear that we are accountable to movements and that I needed to talk to those folks. And so I personally, before accepting those resources on behalf of movement, and again, a good amount of those resources were going to organizations directly, not just through the Solutions Project.
Yeah.
But I personally talked to about 33 labor leaders across the country. And this was important given, you know, Amazon's a big company. Jeff Bezos is a world-renowned name that many know. And there's a lot of controversy around both of those things, whether it's him or his company. And that's not to knock the great people that are working at Amazon and doing good work, because, you know, sure, obviously that's part of the story, too. But given the controversy, I knew that it was important to personally talk to those labor leaders and share the story and share how we started, what the original offer was, what we were able to transform the offer into, and get their blessing to receive those monies and move it to the communities that are most impacted.
So you got their blessing. You got their blessing before you accepted.
Hands down, all of them said, you know, Gloria, this, you know, many folks get a little bit of money. Like, 200,000 and don't have these conversations with each other. And the fact that you have $151 million on the table and you're calling us personally to have this conversation means everything. And so if we trust any organization with these resources, we trust you and the organizations that you all are representing.
How do you maintain that momentum that you're talking about when facing both climate urgency and systemic inequities?
Oh, what comes to mind is the reality that the same systems that created the climate crisis, whether that's colonialism, white supremacy, racism, and the patriarchy, those are the same ones that have harmed communities of color for generations. So when I think about the federal and climate policies and equity investments that have been rolled back and under direct assault, it's no accident that the targeting of climate and equity by authoritarian actors is intentional and calculated. And it's really about weakening movements and grassroots power. And there's a strong interplay between climate and authoritarianism, like the control over land and resources, criminalizing dissent are central to authoritarian playbooks. And so in this moment, when the imperative is to fight for our country and to fight for our democracy, I'd contend that we can't have a democracy without a focus on climate justice. And so in this moment and in this context, that's what's energizing me.
Yeah.
Is making sure that folks understand that climate justice really is the antithesis of an authoritarian agenda. And we don't have to do this work alone. Like, we have a whole infrastructure. The Solutions Project's connected to upwards of 350 plus grassroots organizations across the U.S. that are working to transform communities right now and to build power and to ensure that we all have the rights that our democracy is supposed to protect.
It makes me think of what you brought up about the etymology of philanthropy, its definition, meaning the love of humanity. So for you, how does love fit into the work that you do?
You know, when I think about the dominant theories of change and the worldviews, really, that influence us and shape our democracy and capitalism right now, it's a lot about individualism, competition, the commodification of people and the places that we call home. And when I think about the communities and the grassroots organizations that the Solutions Project supports, it's flipping those worldviews on its head. And it's actually practicing and demonstrating a different way. That's about interconnection. That's about care. That's about the abundance and sharing of resources. And it's about community, recognizing that we don't have to do this work alone. So yes, philanthropy at its heart and in its true meaning is about love, which is why as an organizer, after doing this work for working on the ground for nearly two decades, I'm trying to do my part to move more resources, capital, and shine a light on the solutions that are already happening and underway. And these are solutions that are, yes, benefiting many local communities, but it's benefiting the broader democracy and society as a whole.
Gloria Walton is president and CEO of the Solutions Project. Gloria, thank you so much for spending time with us and talking to us about your work.
Thanks so much for having me.
One example of the kind of organization funded through the Solutions Project is Ho'ahu Energy Cooperative Molokai. Ho'ahu is a community-owned energy company on this small Hawaiian island where the majority of the population is Native Hawaiian.
I think if you grew up on Molokai, you realize that the community here is like no other. So you're just reminded every day that we really have a responsibility to that.
Todd Yamashita is a volunteer board member with the organization. He says that Molokai has some of the highest electricity rates in the country, and that can be tough on the residents.
My neighbor, his electric bill was $700. He doesn't have a job. He has a five-year-old son, and he's begging me for help.
60% of Molokai residents are low to moderate income, and about 40% of those people live below the poverty line.
That's Leilani Chow, projects coordinator for Ho'ahu.
Quite a lot of our people on Molokai live off-grid. They burn propane, and then some people just don't have anything.
Molokai's electricity is so expensive because most of it is generated by burning fossil fuels, which have to be imported. Isaac Moriwake, an environmental attorney with Earth Justice, explains.
Hawaii's the most isolated land on this planet, and it's dependent on imported oil, which is a crazy thought if you think about it. If the ships stop coming, we're screwed, we have no energy, and fossil fuels are expensive.
But this community has rallied together, training their own members to install solar panels. They hope to provide cheap, reliable power to everyone who needs it.
This is now or never. Molokai has never experienced such expensive electricity. If we fail at this, I am afraid to think about what it could mean.
To help meet the need for homegrown power, Ho'ahu offers fully subsidized tuition for clean energy technician training programs. These programs provide photovoltaic solar courses, safety certification, and hands-on building experience. Participants come out of these programs trained and certified to construct small-scale solar systems.
I want you guys to hand me up these two panels. Solar happens to work really, really well in Hawaii. In 6 short months, we've graduated 12 clean energy technicians. We're already installing systems for our friends and neighbors. We are a family. We're creating jobs now in a community where there were no jobs before.
Oh, look at that, 110. We got solar coming off the roof.
In the long run, the investment in renewable energy will almost certainly pay off. But coming up with the initial capital is a challenge for a small, relatively low-income community like this one.
We have the most amazing board. We have the most amazing staff. I am a volunteer. I get paid nothing for this. We're all doing this because it is exciting. I lose sleep at night because I know that if I can just raise enough money, if I can just find the right partners, if I can thread the needle, then, you know, maybe we can make this work.
For Todd Yamashita, this is personal.
I'm trying to leave a legacy for my kids, something that will benefit them and their peers. And the hardest part about climate change is that where I own my family home, where I've built my farm, probably when my kids are just a little older than I am, there's a good chance that that's going to be underwater.
Earth Justice's Isaac Moriwake says that grassroots projects like this can serve as an example of how people can literally take power into their own hands, and not just in Hawaii.
I think Molokai can show how a community like this can come together and drive towards 100% clean energy and achieve these goals from the people, from the community, bottom up.
The Ho'ahu Energy Collective interview audio was generously shared with us by The Years Project, a 501c3 climate media company.
Coming up, why we need to make climate and environmental spaces more inclusive and welcoming for everyone.
Someone at some point would always approach me with this question on their face of, oh, that's interesting that you're interested in this. And I'd go, well, why is that interesting? Because you're interested in climate, so why wouldn't I be interested in climate?
That's up next when Climate One continues. This is Climate One. I'm Ariana Brocious. Wawa Guveru didn't see many people like herself when she began to participate in climate and environmental activism. So she decided to change that. The Gen Z climate activist and Rhodes Scholar is the founder and executive director of Black Girl Environmentalist, a national organization dedicated to helping more Black girls, women, and gender-expansive people enter and lead in the climate space.
My story in regards to joining the climate movement, I think started before I was born. So I come from a long line of farmers as far back as oral history goes back on both sides of my family. Earth stewardship has been a part of our story. And when my parents immigrated to the US, they did so because of lack of opportunity in Kenya, but also because of climate change, because they were experiencing a lot of the dynamics of what is now a 40-year-long drought. And so for them, when they thought about opportunity for their future children, they factored that into their migration story in a lot of ways. So I have connected climate to my genesis as the years have gone on, and I've better understood the reasons why my family went to the U.S. On a more specific aha moment end of things, when I was 15, I stumbled into an environmental science class. And as the story goes, I didn't want to take the class. I thought I was going to be a doctor, didn't do well in chemistry. And the only course that I could take was environmental science. And so I took that class and it ended up changing my life. I had an incredible teacher. Her name was Mrs. Rose, who did such a great job at connecting the dots between climate change and the very real dynamics that myself and my classmates were seeing and experiencing, as well as including a chapter on environmental justice, which really opened my world to the ways that climate change doesn't impact us all the same, and the ways that specifically so many of the communities that I'm a part of, particularly the Black community across the diaspora, and how climate change is disproportionately impacting us while, unfortunately, we aren't adequately represented in climate leadership.
Yeah. So when you were a kid, if someone had asked you to draw a picture of an environmentalist, what would you have drawn?
I would have drawn anything that didn't look like me. You know, I grew up with, like so many other people, feeling as though environmental work at large just required a really fancy science degree, like Patagonia, like liking to go hiking and camping, which is funny because now I love hiking and camping. But at the time, I hadn't had the opportunity to do that until I was in college.
But it's not a prerequisite, right?
And it's not a prerequisite, but it's great if that's what you love to do, right? There's so many different, now I know that there's so many different ways that you can show up as an environmentalist. But at the time, I certainly thought that there was also this requirement of perfection. And I just understood myself as a very imperfect person and couldn't really see myself showing up in a way that I could be maybe a perfect environmentalist. Mm.
I think you focus a lot on this question and need for more diverse representation in the climate space. And I just want to explore that a minute because it's so powerful, especially I think, as you've said, when you're a younger person, to see what's possible, to kind of look to the world as it is and be able to put yourself in it. So can you talk a little about your work expanding this idea of who is in the climate movement?
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because I experienced a lot of those dynamics once I decided to join the climate movement when I was 15. I started showing up at random climate events and showing up at different community meetings and joining clubs at college. And something that really hit me was that it seemed as though in so many of the spaces that I was in, I was the quote unquote only one. I was oftentimes the only person of color. I was almost certainly the only Black person in almost all of the spaces that I frequented. And then when I was in climate spaces outside of my university, I was oftentimes the youngest person by like at least 20 years. And the common denominator was someone at some point would always approach me with this question on their face of, oh, that's interesting that you're interested in this. And I'd go, well, why is that interesting? Because you're interested in climate. So why wouldn't I be interested in climate? Mm-hmm. And I realized through so many of those circumstances that unfortunately, the mainstream climate movement, especially at that time, so we're talking like 8 years, 7 years ago, wasn't as diverse as I think it is now, even though there's a lot of improvements that we can make. And so in a lot of ways, there was some trauma embedded in my pursuit to help cultivate spaces for more people of color and specifically Black girls to see themselves in climate work, especially as I continued to grow in my scholarship and advocacy and began to really understand that there had always been a long, long, long legacy of Black people, folks of color, indigenous folks stewarding the land and having a really deep ancestral connection to earth stewardship and even connecting my own family's history to that legacy. And so I think a huge part of it has been also uncovering the very real history that unfortunately I just didn't get to access as a student and making that more accessible to other people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you touched on this idea of the disproportionate impacts of climate across this country, across the world. Elsewhere in this episode, we talk with Gloria Walton, and she talks about this need to shift the narrative about those most impacted by climate disruption from victim to victor. So how do you see frontline communities portrayed, you know, in the media in like a large sense?
Yeah, that's a great question. And shout out to Gloria. She's wonderful. It's interesting because in some ways I'm in a bubble. I found so much of my climate community in the past 5 years. So I'm actually surrounded by really great climate storytelling often. Like I am surrounded by folks who engage in Hollywood and are really interested in telling authentic stories that are in direct collaboration and in communication with frontline folks. I'm constantly with quote unquote frontline folks as being someone who runs an organization for Black youth, who is a demographic mm-hmm. that is a frontline community in regards to environmental hazards and the climate crisis at large. But I am also very aware that that perception is not everyone's perception. And I've had to build that for myself really intentionally. And so I say that all to say there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. And I think that there's this dichotomy that exists, particularly on social media, where social media really rewards fast, simplified narratives that oftentimes fall into misinformation and voyeurism, especially when it comes to telling stories of climate disaster and maybe sometimes sidelines the climate resilience and even climate joy that can exist when you get involved. Whereas climate storytelling always must lead with truth and nuance. And sometimes the two can feel at odds, but I'm a firm believer that you can do both at the same time. It just, again, requires intention and requires the communities themselves to be in the front seat.
Yeah, I want to unpack that because I think you're a very talented storyteller and you work in this space of social media, which, as you said so accurately, really does reward like simple, easy, digestible, you know, bite-sized, whatever. And a lot of your social media posts are based in some sense around facts, you know, like the Arctic is heating up 4 times faster than anywhere on Earth, or the U.S. is currently producing more oil and gas than any petrostate in history. We talk a lot on our show about how sometimes facts aren't what compels people. There's been science around the impacts of climate change for decades. People have known it, hasn't shifted the action that much. And what really captivates people are stories, you know, like human stories. So how do you kind of balance those when you're creating things to put on your feeds?
To put it plainly, I believe that facts ground us and that stories move us. And that I see them as partners, not as opposites. Anytime we talk about climate, data is grounding all of that, right? Like we understand that the climate crisis is happening because we have a plethora of data and also we have a plethora of lived experience. And so that data helps people understand the scale of the crisis. And stories do that as well. But I think where stories really have a unique hold on people is that they allow people to see themselves inside of it. I think we're at a point where we have data paralysis. We've got so much data. There's always a report, and those reports are so important, obviously, but we're not going to report our way out of this in transforming people's minds and hearts. It's through telling stories and it's through connecting with people on an emotional level, because climate change is a deeply emotional problem. And this is where we have to really move from this technocratic language of climate change. And we need to infuse this idea that there are ways for us to solve this crisis, and that the climate crisis, in my opinion, is an opportunity for us to finally build a world that's just for all of us, and that there are few other opportunities for us to do that as a species.
Yeah. So you've said that narrative change comes down to crafting a narrative that dismantles another prevailing narrative that can be harmful. what harmful climate narratives are you working to dismantle? Do you want to like even give them space and list them, or would you rather focus on like the ones that you want to see?
You know, I think I really like to encourage conversations of nuance. And I think a great example of that is when we talk about climate grief, eco-anxiety, rage, anger, hopelessness, all these very complex emotional responses to climate change that I feel that, at least in my personal experience, when I first started really feeling those things, I felt so embarrassed and I felt like I was a failure. I was like, how can I call myself an environmentalist? How can I say that I do climate work? How can I say that I'm a proponent of environmental justice when I'm having cold sweats in the middle of the night? Like, that's not something people want to hear on stage. They want to hear someone who's like, you shouldn't feel these things, et cetera. And so now I'm very open about those feelings with people that I don't know, with people that I do know, because I think that we have to reframe these conversations and say, okay, the reality is that the discomfort that so many of us have around the climate crisis is a sign that you're awake to what's happening. In fact, I would be worried about someone witnessing and experiencing climate disaster and feeling nothing. It is so human to feel all those things. And taking a step further, I think we have to feel it. We have to feel it. We have to have better conversations and actually have some sort of literacy, like emotional literacy of like how to navigate these things and then do something with it. Those emotions are incredibly powerful. Like, angry people get a lot of shit done. Like, when I'm angry, like, that's when I'm like, this grant no, is it just can
be,
gonna...
it can be empowering.
You know? And I think we have to let people know that. And that starts with being honest with ourselves and then with others.
Yeah, there's so much in there I want to respond to. I agree wholeheartedly that you have to be a sentient being, right? Like, you can't sort of operate in this dispassionate space around facts and figures, and that by feeling those emotions fully, as awful as it is sometimes, really connects you to the reason for why we're doing the work, right? I want to pivot back for a second to the work you're doing in creating more inclusive spaces, because I think this is so fundamental. So your group, your organization, Black Girl Environmentalist, now has more than 2,000 members and is recognized as one of the largest Black youth-led organizations in the country. What does that growth tell us about the demand for more inclusive climate spaces?
Yeah, it's been really exciting to see the way that the organization has scaled, especially since we started out as a digital page. Like, we quite literally began with the most Gen Z genesis, which is an Instagram page. And I was just super lonely dealing with all of these prevailing conversations and just really needed desperately community. And so we started out as an Instagram page that would move to Zoom and have these huge video calls where people would talk about their experiences in the environmental space, which then moved into virtual happy hours and virtual panels and networking hours. And eventually, after I finished my graduate studies at Oxford, I decided to take a chance on this little digital community and see if there was a way to utilize all of what I had learned from the community that I had helped facilitate online for several years and transform it into an in-person organization that could help address so many of these really unique issues around pathway and retention that specifically impacts Black girls and Black gender expansive youth in particular. And so now our organization has three impact areas: community empowerment, narrative change, and green workforce development. And through the lens of those impact areas, we have six national programs that do their best at addressing these prevailing issues. I just got back from Oregon, actually. We were there last week, and it was just so beautiful to see these 16 early career Black women and Black gender expansive emerging climate leaders be so firm in their commitment to climate work, and who now have these experiences that are going to hopefully continue to ground them as they grow in their leadership. And I'm very, very excited to watch them. And I feel like the work that BGE is doing as an organization that is made up of the very demographic that we're working to support really gives us this unique edge and ability to address in really intentional ways.
Yeah, that's so empowering just hearing you describe how much thought and care has gone into creating a program like that, to have those people take more leadership on and continue to evolve in their careers. You've talked about fighting for an age of, quote, unprecedented care. What does that look like in practice?
I think it means a lot of different things. I've learned a lot from abolitionist frameworks, to be honest, and abolitionists about what climate justice really means to me and what it is that I'm fighting for. And I actually wish we had more space in the climate movement to dream and to think radically about what it is that we're building. And I completely understand why there is a lack of space given to that, because the urgency of the crisis is just so overwhelming. And I think we have to get in a practice of doing that. And so I've been trying to lean into that practice more and more this year. That was one of my New Year's resolutions that I've actually kept up with. Mm-hmm. I would love for, you know, us not to have to build a climate movement made in the image of all of us. I wish we didn't live in a world where children had to be activists. And those are things that I'm thinking about and would like to have actualized. And I don't know if they're possible in my lifetime, but I'll do my best to contribute to making them a reality for someone at some point.
Wawa Guvero is founder and executive director of Black Girl Environmentalist. Thank you so much for joining us on Climate One.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, everyone. It's Kusha and Ariana. We are coming to the end of our show, and that means it is time for Climate One More Thing. Ariana, what do you got?
Yeah, I read an article this week that there's new research out in the journal Nature that found there are far fewer good places to store carbon dioxide underground than we previously thought. And this is a little bit of a not good news story, because according to the article that I read in Grist, that's only equal to about as much carbon dioxide as would cut global warming by 0.7 degrees Celsius. And previously, we have thought that we could store enough carbon dioxide to equal about 6 degrees Celsius. So that's a huge difference. That's less than 1 degree. And it means that we really have to focus on reducing emissions before they happen, as many people have argued, rather than this kind of after-the-fact solution.
I saw this article, and you're right, it's not great news. There are other strategies, just to, like, you know, think outside the carbon dioxide sequestration box. We did an episode about super pollutants, atmosphere pollutants besides carbon dioxide, that could definitely are like low-hanging fruit in cleaning up the air. Yeah, so it is a bit of a bummer to hear, but there is a way forward, I think.
Yeah, it's good to know what we can and can't do. And again, I think that a lot of the consensus broadly in the climate space is that carbon sequestration was never really going to save our bacon. It was like one tool in the tool basket. So I think it still remains there, but it's less powerful than maybe we thought. Kusha, what about you?
So, yeah, I can go as well. So a few weeks ago, I asked for advice about running on a treadmill. And Ariana, I got some advice. And I was so delighted that I did. I just wanted to give a shout out to Allison, to Carlo, and to Charles, who are three of our wonderful listeners who all emailed me and gave me some good advice, some highlights. Carlo suggested that I do ladder intervals to break up the miles. Allison said, go run somewhere else, take a road trip and find some place that would be fun. And one of my favorite things, I just want to shout out Charles. He wrote me a 2-line email. All he said was, listen to Climate One episodes. That's what I do. So I just wanted to thank everybody listening right now for helping one guy make treadmill running a little bit more fun. And if you have more advice, my email is always open, kusha@climateone.org.
That's great. I'm so happy to hear that people responded and you got good advice. So that's our show. Thanks for listening. You can see what our team is reading by subscribing to our newsletter. Sign up at climateone.org.
Climate One is a production of the Commonwealth Club. Our team includes Greg Dalton, Brad Marshland, Jenny Park, Ariana Brocious, Austin Colon, and Megan Basilia. Our theme music is by George Young. I'm Kusha Navdar.